and welcome to Nations of Charlemagne, episode 21, German Dualism. Now, what do I mean by German Dualism? I already see someone in the chat saying, is this something to do with Hegel's dialectic? No. German Dualism is a word, or Deutsches Dualismus, refers to the period of Austro-German rivalry, or the creation of a diarchy, a dual power within Germany or the Holy Roman Empire. Now, we're looking at this in the context of the nationalist historiography around the turn of the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the 1800s, the 19th century, where we have people like Schiller, the famous poet and historian, Friedrich Schiller, and Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, especially Schiller in particular, writing his history on the 30 Years' War and coining this idea of the German schism, that of the religious schism in Germany in the 16th century, and the political division and schism which emerges out of it. And I want to push back against this. Obviously, this is written in the context of national disintegration, national disgrace, the idea that France is consolidating, Spain is consolidating, Great Britain is consolidating, but Germany is divided, Germany is weak, Germany is racked by these constant conflicts. The beginning of the rumblings of the intellectual impetus behind German nationalism, the German new humanism. Yet at the same time, I want to sort of emphasize that all of this is in no way sort of teleological. I don't expect sort of anything coming out of the 30 Years' War. And what I'm really going to emphasize in this lecture is I'm not going to emphasize it purely on Prussia. I want this to be a German lecture and a German history lecture concerning everything from the end of the 30 Years' War until the death of Frederick the Great in 1786. And I do that just to emphasize how strange so many of the instances are we see across this period and how unexpected Prussia's particular rise to power is. It's not simply a case of first there's the religious schism, first then there's the political schism, then out of it there is a new power to take the mantle away from Austria. It's far more complicated than that, and I'll be one of the first to say that Austria, if you look at this map, actually did pretty well in all consideration out of the 30 Years' War. Austria emerges with the least level of devastation compared to other lands such as the Palatinate, such as Brandenburg, Prussia, all the more remarkable looking at this map, as it'll actually be from the northeast, where the major contender to Prussian power eventually arises. And even the region of Silesia here, which is going to be so economically and politically significant for this lecture, is also devastated during this period. And just talking about all the sort of wrong turns we see in history, I want to talk briefly before we get started about the history of the Palatinate, which was really the anti-Austrian, anti-Habsburg protagonist we saw during the early stages of the 30 Years' War, and see how, when talking about some sort of teleology of, one state within Germany taking the reins of German power, as Prussia would do in 1870, how unlikely this was, and again, how ill all the other powers that had tried this originally had fared. So looking at the Palatinate, after the demise of Frederick V, the Winter King of Bohemia, the Palatinate was controlled by Maximilian of Bavaria for some 25 years before returning to the Palatinate branch of the family under Charles I Louis. And it's interesting that he's more known for his role in betraying the royalist faction and siding with the parliamentarians in the English Civil War than he is for his impact on German history. The branch of the family that he would represent would go extinct and ultimately would be inherited by the Camp Palatines of Neuburg, which were Catholic Wittelsbachs and allies to the emperor through marriage. So all the more remarkable that the great Calvinist protagonist of the 30 Years' War, his dynasty will be wiped out, faded into irrelevance, and replaced by loyal allies of the emperor and the House of Neuburg. Now, getting on to where Prussia figures into this, the brief history of Prussia. Well, Prussia, of course, during this period is known as Brandenburg, Brandenburg, Prussia. Prussia is a little enclave surrounded by Polish-Lithuanian territory in the east. In fact, it's not sovereign. It's a duchy under the nominal suzerainty or overlordship of the Polish-Lithuanian king and Grand Duke. And within the German domains, we have the Elector of Brandenburg, who again is but a vassal nominally of the Holy Roman Emperor. And just a little point to note is that John Sigismund, the man who acquires Prussia to the electorate of Brandenburg, converts to Calvinism and fails to convert his state, i.e. following the legal practice of forcefully converting all your denizens to your preferred religion, to Calvinism. And so Prussia remains officially Lutheran, but with a Calvinist princely dynasty, the Hohenzollern dynasty. So without further ado, with that little bit of setup, we'll go on to what happens immediately after the 30 Years' War. So with the Peace of Westphalia, the 30 Years' War is ended, and there is a great sort of population decimation, as sort of indicated by this map here. In 1600, the population of the Holy Roman Empire, which as you can see is quite a lot larger than the modern borders of Germany, is around 20 million. And this goes down to about 13 million in 1648, 50 years later, after the conclusion of the war. And the ultimate effect of the war is the confirmation of German liberties, the formalization of the decentralization of the empire, and consequently, contrary to this, the consolidation of the Habsburg territories, so the Archduchy of Austria and the Kingdom of Bohemia. And increasingly, we see the growth of professional armies and growing loyalty, subordination to local state authority, as opposed to the mercenary armies, which are so prevalent at the beginning of this conflict. And we see foreign nations, such as Sweden in Pomerania and France in Alsace, encroaching on the legal German territory, the legal territory of the empire. The Holy Roman Emperor, you can see the Holy Roman Emperor at this time, the rather ridiculous figure you see in the middle, in imitation of Louis XIV here, is Leopold, Emperor Leopold von Habsburg. And he is far more concerned with affairs in Hungary throughout his reign and affairs concerning France than he is with consolidating his control over Germany. And we'll get to his interesting German policy a little bit later. And amidst this context, with the Emperor Leopold and the devastation wrought by the 30 Years' War, we see the quiet rise of the unexpected protagonist of this lecture, the rise of Brandenburg Prussia under its elector, Frederick Wilhelm, the Great Elector. Now, the 30 Years' War had killed off roughly half the population of Brandenburg Prussia. The urban population had declined from something like 300,000 before the war to 75,000. Even Magdeburg, which would be eventually given to Brandenburg in 1618, had been singularly devastated during the war as the site of the Magdeburg Massacre. One of the elector's military adventures to expand his influence in the Jülichburg, these tiny little territories in the west on the Rhine, at the expense of the Catholic Count of Palatine-Neuburg, failed. Prussia and Brandenburg was considered so impotent that the conflict was dubbed the Elector's Cow's War, because the only achievement of Brandenburg was the theft of some cattle. Brandenburg was effectively overshadowed by Sweden through its conquest of parts of Pomerania, and also, importantly, controlling the mouth of the River Oder, which is now the eastern border of Germany. What then was a vital transport link and trade link for the state of Brandenburg at the city of Stettin, which is now Szczecin in Poland. Brandenburg impotence again was proved when the elector had to yield to Sweden in Prussia proper during the deluge. And this is referring to the fact that the Swedish invaded Poland in the 1650s, ultimately in concert with Russian overtures during that region. And the elector had essentially to surrender his provinces in East Prussia to station and supply the Swedish invasion route into Poland, even though the elector was always sort of very ambitious and he was prepared to switch sides depending on which way the war was going. So when it looked like Sweden was actually going to be defeated, the elector turned around and sided with the Polish and fought against the Swedes. In imitation of France, as Louis XIV was assuming his personal rule, the Great Elector embarked on the creation of a standing army, believing without it, his devastated principality had no prospects. Akin to France, the elector confirmed the privileges of the nobility, their exemption from taxes, and their rights to serfs, while obliging the estates and the towns to provide contributions to the army rather than feudal levies. By the time of his death, Little Brandenburg, Prussia, had a standing army of some 30,000 men. And just to emphasize that if you do want to ask questions, do wait until I finish the lecture at the end and I will answer them. Brandenburg, Prussia's fortunes turned when Sweden invaded yet again as France's ally in her wars against the Holy Roman Empire throughout the 1670s. So this would be principally the French-Dutch War. At Fehrbellin in 1675, Brandenburg was able to defeat a larger Swedish army without foreign assistance. And this is sort of the first time that Brandenburg was able to hold its own against a nominal great power, because Sweden is the dominant power in the Baltic at the moment. It is the great power. It was the great military protagonist for the Protestant cause during the 30 Years' War. And Brandenburg at the moment is nothing but a backwater. But slowly but surely, the great elector is consolidating Prussian power and securing a military base vis-a-vis the Swedes. And by 1678, Brandenburg had pushed the Swedish out of Pomerania, occupying it and removing Swedish forces from Prussia also during a remarkable episode, which you should look up, called the Great Sleigh Drive, liberating Prussia during winter using sleighs. Only a direct intervention from the Swedes' ally, the French, forced the elector to abandon most of his gains. But nevertheless, all of this had indicated that Brandenburg was a power in his own right, and he was now a prestigious leader who held some account in international affairs. An attempt by France to woo the electors to switch sides was dashed when Louis XIV issued the Edict of Fontainebleau, the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. And again, this is the removing of all rights afforded to French Huguenots during the Kingdom of France. And to counteract this, the great elector issued his own edict, the Edict of Potsdam, encouraging Huguenots to come to Brandenburg. And during his lifetime, which was, you know, just a couple more years, an estimated 20,000 Huguenots from France would come to Brandenburg. Now, the Edict of Brandenburg isn't just a case of altruism or, again, looking for prestige on the part of the king, or trying to own France in some way, to put it rather crassly. But the fact is, the French Huguenots were skilled. They played a prominent part in French society as, you know, members of the bourgeoisie, or in German, the Bürgerliche. And moreover, they were Calvinist. And remember that Prussia is a, or rather Brandenburg Prussia at this time, is a Lutheran state ruled over by a Calvinist dynasty. So we have a large immigrant community personally linked to the ruler by their Calvinist beliefs, strengthening the ruler's own position in relation to the landed nobility and the powerful Lutheran interests. Essentially, the Huguenots established a vertical relationship between the crown and are dependent on the crown, and so serve the crown. In a northern German state, in an ultimate German backwater, only limited access to natural resources, there was a compelling economic case to be made for returning productive usage of land, returning to the productive usage of land, which had been abandoned. And again, just to emphasize this point, look at the devastation we see in this map in the north, mainly around the areas of Pomerania, and right in the center, the area north of Berlin, the Uckermark. And here we have the instance of Jean Harlem, a Huguenot based in Calais, and 20 years old when the Edict of Fontainebleau was proclaimed in France in 1685. Among others, he escaped in a boat along the English Channel, traveling as far as the Dutch coast, and the Prussians had set up transit posts, or essentially way stations in the Netherlands, where they provided documentation and financial support to encourage Huguenots to choose Prussia. And in this case, Harlan was provided support to move to Uckermark, north of Berlin, where he met another Huguenot, Mary Lejeune, who had managed to escape France with her three children and married. And here they were allocated an empty farmstead and began building and seeding corn, horses, cattle. And with this small little base and a tiny bit of money to encourage their output, the farmstead essentially resulted in the beginning of a thriving immigrant community in the Uckermark. And the various privileges afforded to people like Jean Harlem meant that he in particular would go on to form a commercial dynasty. So these were a political and economic boon, the Huguenot populations, to the Hohenzollern rulers at the time. In diplomacy, the elector turned to Leopold, again the Holy Roman Emperor, to cement an alliance as part of the Grand Alliance against France in 1686. It is telling that the emperor was prepared to cede territory to Brandenburg to gain this alliance, an indication that the balance of power changed to favour Brandenburg. 10 years prior, the elector had laid claim to the ancient Hohenzollern rights to various duchies in Silesia, dating from a 1537 succession treaty involving the then pious rulers of the Duchy of Liegnitz, Wolau, and Brieg. The Habsburgs, who had escheated the territories as the kings of Bohemia, to escheat when you have territories which normally belong to a crown. Escheating the territories means that when these territories lose their ruler, their vassal ruler, because the line has become extinct, because they form part of the legal territory of some higher authority like a kingdom, escheating means that those territories revert back to the throne, as was the case in Bohemia, because Silesia, as you can see on this map in the east, the orange part in the northeast of the Habsburg crown, was part of the kingdom of Bohemia and thus connected to the Habsburgs. The Hohenzollern claim was subsequently ignored, and various Prussians, so for example, one of the early sort of conflicts in the Thirty Years' War was when the Prussians tried to rally the Silesian estates to their side, and they were subsequently crushed by Ferdinand II of Austria and Bohemia. And this is sort of, again, indicates that from that, not taking the Brandenburgers in any way seriously, by 1686, the Emperor Leopold was prepared to siege the small enclave of Schwabus, which is now Schwabodzen in Poland, to Brandenburg, albeit temporarily. And moving away briefly from Prussia, so that's really the introduction to the situation in Brandenburg, Prussia, and the nucleus of the state, which is going to transform into the situation where we bring about the idea of German dualism post-1763. I want to talk about this age of aspiring German would-be kings and how Prussia was had very good company in this stage, and there was no indication that Prussia had some sort of right to become Austria's partner in the affairs of Germany. The time of the War of the Spanish Succession was a time of ambitious princes aspiring to kingdoms for their respective dynasties. Other than the ambitious House of Savoy in Italy, Germany, with its hundreds of Kleinstaaterei, effectively little statelets, was host to four ambitious princes in particular who I'm going to mention. The first is someone I briefly alluded to in my previous lecture, which is Maximilian Emmanuel II of Bavaria. The second is Augustus the Strong of Saxony. The third, I'm sure you're aware of, is George I of Hanover and later Great Britain. And the fourth is Frederick III of Brandenburg, Prussia. Now, the Wittelsbach-Habsburg rivalry has long been documented on this channel. Maximilian I was a key player and instigator of the Thirty Years' War, and despite the early success in that war, he'd been able to unify the Wittelsbach patrimony in Germany. Albeit he was forced temporarily to, give over and divide the Palatinate, return it to Charles Louis, and separate the Wittelsbach dynasty yet again. His successor, Ferdinand Maria, was a capable peacetime ruler who left the state prosperous, commissioning Bavaria's answer to Louis XIV's Versailles, the Nymphenburg Palace. Having served in the wars against the Ottomans with Eugene of Savoy and as governor of the Spanish Netherlands, modern-day Belgium, Maximilian Emmanuel could have launched Bavaria as a major power, utilizing his son's claim to Spain. In the event, as we have seen in the previous episode, the elector's ambitions came to naught, and in siding with France over the emperor, he met with disaster at the Battle of Blenheim against the Duke of Marlborough and against Eugene of Savoy. And after the Spanish Netherlands was conquered by Austria in 1706, he lived as mere guest at the Palace of Versailles. He is the only figure on this list who was denied a kingship, yet Bavarians will enter our story later on. Despite his military defeat, his lands were restored after that conflict, and rather than increase the size of his Bavarian Wittelsbach holdings by force, he reverted to the ancient Bavarian ambitions for the emperorship, ancient in the sense that the Wittelsbach dynasty actually claimed the office of Holy Roman Emperor before the Habsburgs did during the 14th century in the reign of Louis IV or Ludwig IV, depending on what language you're using. Through the Counts of Neuburg and his own branch of the family, the Wittelsbachs had control now of four votes in the Imperial College, which is an important consideration just to bear in mind, this being Bavaria, Palatinate, Cologne, and Trier. And again, the empire is still elective It's not hereditary. There are 8 electors at this point, were 7 established in the Golden Bull. There are now 8 because the Palatinate and Bavaria have their own electors. And so you need a majority, but normally the emperor is elected unanimously by this imperial college. In the case of Saxony, Saxony really is one of these wonderful examples in German history where nothing follows an obvious or thematic or, dare I say, teleological course. Indeed, the case of Saxony is very strange indeed. Rather, I shouldn't have said indeed twice there. Beginning as a leading light in the Lutheran Revolution in Germany alongside the Landgraves of Hesse, the Elector of Saxony, Maurice, was integral in imposing on Charles V, or rather essential, in imposing on Charles V the Peace of Augsburg, undoing his plans for a general religious reconciliation in the empire, and thereby guaranteeing Maurice, the Elector of Saxony, the rights of the Lutheran princes, the so-called German liberty, which is rather a reinterpretation of the rights established by the Golden Bull of 1356, which established anarchy or decentralization within the empire. And with Augsburg, you combine a religious element to this, which is confirmed for Calvinists at Westphalia. Rather than being a straightforward advocate for Lutheran rights, a position later adopted by Gustavus Adolphus of Sweden, or challenge Habsburg authority, a position later adopted by Frederick V of the Palatinate, the Winter King, after Maurice died, Saxony pursued a middle course, often allying themselves with the emperor. Indeed, by the time of Johann George III, the Saxon Mars, a god of war, Saxony had positioned itself as the champion of the smaller German princes against French aggression, not the aggression of the Holy Roman Emperor. In 1694, Augustus, pictured here in the centre, became the Elector of Saxony. Setting his sights on obtaining a kingly dignity, he looked, interestingly enough, to Poland. In 1697, Jan Sobieski died. Jan Sobieski, of course, is the famous Polish king who leads the charge of the winged Polish hussars at the Siege of Vienna, routing the forces of Karl and Mustafa Pasha and aiding Eugene of Savoy in his reconquest of much of Europe. After his death, and considering Poland was an elective monarchy, the dynasty essentially could be taken by foreign nobility. One of the first instances to take this was the later Henry III of France. And therefore, the Saxons looked to Poland as their opportunity to attain a kingdom. However, because Poland was not only Catholic, but vehemently Catholic, the fact that the electors of Saxony were Protestant, not only that, but they were the champions of the Lutheran cause for the most part in the last 200 years. They were naturally disqualified. And so to make himself eligible for the throne, Augustus nominally converted to Catholicism and bribed the Polish nobility and clergy to ensure the success of this so-called Polish adventure. This, much to the horror of his German allies. Now Saxony had all but abandoned its earlier position as the leader of Protestant princes in Germany to pursue a Polish foreign policy. And indeed, this alienated his Lutheran subjects as well. What is more bizarre is that this conversion was seen as purely cosmetic, as Saxony remained a Lutheran state, nor did he, as with Brandenburg, afford religious rights to his own new co-religionists, i.e. the Catholics. As Augustus wanted his own son, who would later become Augustus III, to succeed him in Poland, the cornerstone of his ambition was to make Poland a hereditary state of the Wettin dynasty, the dynasty ruling over Saxony. Therefore, his son was also obliged to convert to Catholicism. What made this all the more remarkable was that the Saxon legacy of the Reformation entitled the elector to hold the hereditary office of director of the Protestant bloc in the German Reichstag, an honour which the Saxon electors maintained despite all of them being Catholic throughout the 18th century. The Wettin ambitions for Poland elevated the house to that of kings, and yet they were unable to make effective use of Poland and Lithuania as their own power base. Upon his election, Augustus allied with Peter the Great against Sweden in the Great Northern War, hoping to gain control over Swedish Livonia, a territory which is, I don't have a map of it here, but it's roughly corresponding to modern-day Latvia and Estonia. Charles XII, judging that Poland was the senior of the two powers he encountered, defeated Peter the Great decisively at the Battle of Narva, the First Battle of Narva in 1702, and then laid waste to the Polish army, deposing Augustus of Saxony in 1706 and placing his own ally Stanislaw on the throne of Poland-Lithuania. Augustus was able to regain the throne only with Russian support after Poltava in 1709, and increasingly thereafter, Poland-Lithuania was entering into Russia's orbit rather than Saxony's. To maintain his nominal kingdom, Augustus conceded more rights to the Polish nobility, who increasingly espoused Russian interests, often bribed by the Russians. He was able, marring a succession war, to ensure the election of his son as King of Poland, whose reign would be a disaster both for Poland and for Saxony. The culmination of the Saxon ambition was to see Poland delivered as a client state to the Russians and Saxony itself routinely occupied by the Prussians. Now coming to a more, I don't have an image here, but coming to a more successful instance of a German state forming a successful personal union, we of course come to an example which I'm sure many of you might be aware of, which is the case of Hanover. Originally the Duchy of Brunswick and Lüneburg, it was the ancient patrimony of Henry the Lion of the House of Welf, who you'll remember if you remember back to the episode of Guelphs and Ghibellines. He was the main antagonist to Frederick Barbarossa, which is where we get the term Guelphs, Ghibellines. Guelph, the Italian rendition of Welf, Ghibelline, the Italian rendition of Wiederbungen, which is the German residence of the House of Hohenstaufen. However, despite this grand patrony dating back to Frederick Barbarossa, the House of Welf had become essentially an increasing irrelevance compared to the other great German houses, you know, Wettin, Habsburg, Wittelsbach, owing in part to the fact that the family didn't introduce primogeniture until the 17th century in their Brunswick holdings. Consequently, the Welf patrimony was shared out among all the sons of those claiming the title of the Duke. Ernest Augustus, the father of the future George I of Great Britain, was fortunate in that he inherited many of the Brunswicks, whose own dynasties had gone extinct. By 1692, there were only two Brunswick patrimonies, the Hanoverian one under Ernest Augustus, and called Hanoverian because that's where the Duke resided, and the other, the Hohenbuchel branch, which would later become the Duchy of Brunswick in the 19th century. Hanover was controversially elevated to the rank of Elector in 1692, making Hanover the ninth Elector, as part of the ongoing wars between the Emperor and France. Again, this is an indication of Leopold's strategy, where he's more than prepared to elevate the princes of Germany in his own conflict against France, often in hindsight with ruinous results to Austria. While the Elector of Hanover, or rather the Electorate of Hanover, was now a regional power in Germany, Ernest Augustus had the fortune of marrying Sophia of the Palatinate, daughter of the Winter King, though the significance of what that was not apparent when the couple married in 1658, and here we come, I'll briefly touch on the Stuart succession. Of course, we have the Glorious Revolution in 1688, the mainline Stuarts are deposed, and a Protestant branch of the Stuarts, along with William of Orange, come and take over the throne in 1688, and they confirm this takeover in 1701, whereby only Protestants can acquire the throne, disinheriting the mainline Stuarts who are now based in France. Now, the effect of this means that post-1701, Queen Anne, who will become queen in 1702 and die in 1714, doesn't have any male children or any children. She's unfortunately known notoriously for having a series of miscarriages. And so one had to find one prince who was related to the Stuart dynasty or any of the previous English kings who was Protestant. And going the very obscure route of going through the Elizabeth, who was the wife of Frederick V and her daughter, Sophia, we arrive at Sophia of the Palatinate as the natural heir to Queen Anne, and she is now in her 80s. She doesn't live long enough in order to become Queen of England, but her son does become king, that of George I in 1714 when Queen Anne dies, thus beginning the Hanoverian dynasty in England, which will last from 1714 all the way up until Queen Victoria dies in 1901. And in addition to, you know, having now the throne of Great Britain, which is to emerge as the great power in Europe, indeed the world, over the course of the next century, the Hanoverians use this this extra sort of prestige to acquire various minor German territories like Halden and Verden. And the significance of this is that by the beginning of the 18th century, by 1714, two of the German electors now hold the thrones of two major European powers. And in the case of Hanover, it's a hereditary position, unlike that of Saxony, which, as I've described, is far more precarious. At last, we return to Brandenburg. When Frederick III inherited the state of the Great Elector, Prussia was at once part of the imperial coalition, opposing France, and consciously imitating its style with the help of the Huguenots. So French ostentation and anti-French foreign policy. Like his Saxon counterpart, Frederick aspired to a royal dignity, and following the Hanoverian example, essentially, where Hanover was elevated to the rank of electorate in order to fight the French, the elector Frederick appealed to Leopold to be elevated further to become a king. And the interesting legal loophole they found is that because Prussia, which was a little enclave, situated right in the extreme northeast corner of the map here, is a tiny little enclave which lay outside of the Holy Roman Empire, which was, again, part of the suzerainty of the Kingdom of Poland. Because of that technicality, and because there could not be any other kingdoms, essentially the kingdoms of the Holy Roman Empire at that time were the kingdoms of Bohemia, the kingdoms of Italy, the kingdoms of Germany, and the kingdoms of Burgundy or the Aralat. All of them were held by the Holy Roman Emperor. So the Holy Roman Emperor had no interest in establishing a new king within the patrimony of the Holy Roman Empire. So instead, the emperor, in addition to gaining his support, essentially Frederick I was a mercenary king. He established Prussia as a mercenary state, giving its army as a professional army for hire to fight the French. And in so doing, the reward Prussia was given for loaning its army for use by the Austrians against the French was to have it elevated to a royal dignity, but not as king of Prussia or king of Brandenburg, but king in Prussia. And only the sort of reason it's called Prussia and not Brandenburg is based on this legal technicality of the fact that Prussia, the East Prussian domains, lay outside of the Holy Roman Empire. So therefore, little Brandenburg Prussia simply became the Kingdom of Prussia, and its king, the King in Prussia. All these are little ways to get around insulting the honor of the Holy Roman Emperor, and for the Prussians to assume sort of greater airs than they were really entitled to. So that sort of completes the roster of the various German princes who aspired and succeeded in attaining some sort of a royal dignity, just to indicate the possible contenders we have for this idea of setting up a system of dual leadership over Germany, German dualismus. And it's here where we get to Frederick II's father, Frederick Wilhelm I, who ruled from 1713 to 1740. Now, compared with the ostentation of the first king of Prussia, Frederick I, Frederick the Great would later deem that his grandfather showed greatness in matters that were small. Frederick Wilhelm I was an austere and puritanical ruler, micromanaging the affairs of a small kingdom and often to great avail. He reformed the Prussian tax system, reclaimed marshlands, and introduced strict regulations for Prussian bureaucrats, and continued his grandfather's policy, that being the Great Elector, of inviting Protestant migrants to cultivate land. Frederick Wilhelm I made the young Crown Prince Frederick, later Frederick the Great, work in the region's provinces, teaching the boy about the area's agriculture and geography. This created an interest in cultivation and development that the prince retained when he became the ruler himself, draining swamps and opening new farmland for colonizers who would increase the kingdom's food supply. Frederick II called it Peuplierungspolitik, or peopling policy. To Voltaire, he declared, "Whoever improves the soil cultivates the land. Lying waste and drained swamps is making conquests from barbarism." Using improved technology enabled him to create new farmland through a massive draining program in the country's Oderbruch marshland in the east, so the area just east of Berlin. And this program in particular created 150,000 acres of new farmland. Frederick saw this project as taming and conquering the land from nature. He presided over the construction of canals for bringing crops to market, introduced new crops, especially the potato and the turnip, to the country. For this, he was sometimes called Der Kartoffelkönig, the potato king. Now back to Frederick William I. He may have been overshadowed historically by his son Frederick II the Great, but Frederick Wilhelm I was the original soldier king, Soldatenkönig. Conscription was introduced and organized through a system of cantons, or military districts. Prussian troops boasted a faster rate of fire than any other army in Europe. Roughly 1 in 30 Prussian subjects were soldiers, meaning that despite the state's small population, its army by 1740 was the fourth largest in Europe. The officers of the army were the service nobility in imitation of France. The Junkers, literally the young lords, younger sons of the nobility, filled the ranks of the so-called service nobility. Prior to the Prussian military reforms, a good number of poorer Junkers took up careers as soldiers, mercenaries, and officials, Kammerjunker, or lords of the council chamber, at the court of various territorial princes on the East Fringe. These families were mostly part of the medieval civilization, which had essentially taken place during the Osiedlung. So many of these dynasties have been around since the 13th century. Over the centuries, they become influential commanders and landowners, especially as would later happen with the eastern provinces, what would later become the Kingdom of Prussia. It should be noted that the nobility of Brandenburg before this, in the medieval period, had been prone to banditry, and Brandenburg in particular was one of the worst places in Europe when it came to robber barons, essentially lords using their castles and using their various tolls, lands, levies to ransom, steal, tolls, etc., all sorts of manner of outlawry. As landed aristocrats, the Junkers owned now most arable land in Prussia. Being the bulwark of the ruling House of Hohenzollern, the Junkers commanded the Prussian army, leading in political influence and social status, and owning immense estates worked by tenants. Exemplifying the army's relationship to their warlord, the king hearkened back to these Teutonic aspirations, the Teutonic order as inspiration for military virtue. And just a little note, this despite the order continuing to exist and being Catholic rather than Calvinist. So combine this idea of some sort of a romantic association with the Teutonic order, and the king, Frederick Wilhelm I, in his own way, combined this with his own interpretation of strict Calvinism. So here, these so-called Prussian virtues, we have discipline, funny enough, austerity, which again is something that the king very much wanted to emphasize, or in German, Sparsamkeit, probity, or Redlichkeit, humility, Bescheidenheit, and loyalty, Treue. And a distinct Prussian form of religious worship, or freedom of religious worship, based on this idea of ecumenism, tolerance, not just for Christian denominations, but also for Jews and various other new secret societies which are popping up. Let everyone find salvation according to their own beliefs. All of these aspects we will find in Frederick the Great, notably in his Anti-Machiavel, published in 1739, in French, where Frederick declared that as king, he was the first servant of state. Though perhaps the soldier king, Frederick Wilhelm I, differs from his forebears and his immediate successor in his disdain for ostentation, in particularly in his language, and stylistic preferences for German over French, which bordered on chauvinism for all things French, unless it pertained to his own Huguenot subjects. Now, there's one little thing I want to note, which is often, I think, overlooked, which is the connection to Charles XII and Frederick Wilhelm's own fleeting involvement in the Great Northern War. Of course, Sweden was, during the Great Northern War, the great Baltic power, and from 1701 until 1718, Charles XII of Sweden fights continuous wars and is ultimately defeated. And at his death in 1718, Sweden is very much a reduced power. And Prussia, of course, directly benefits from this and begins seizing some, but not all, of Sweden's territories. Sweden would remain holding territories until after the Napoleonic Wars in Germany. However, there's one influence I really want to emphasize, which is this idea of military virtue, Prussian virtue, and especially Protestant religiosity associated with the proper conduct of the army was something which was inculcated in the army of Charles XII as well, which exhibited many of these same virtues. So I think very much whilst we see that the Great Elector and Frederick I in particular were looking to France for inspiration in forming an absolutist state with a large standing army and with a service nobility, where the nobility were levying their own troops troops, however they were leading and acting as commanders within a professional army under the direct control of the king. What we see is that with Charles XII, we see this indirect influence of this idea of the army as virtuous, a small, disciplined body exhibiting certain virtues. And I think this rubs off quite obviously on Frederick Wilhelm. So the Prussians are more than willing to imitate and learn from their nominal adversaries, the great powers of Sweden and France. Despite the size of the Prussian kingdom, and as you can see on this map, it really is rather tiny, the king left it with a vast treasury and the most highly trained army in Europe, despite having remained for the most part at peace throughout the entirety of his reign. The king was no saint, despite the emphasis on virtue. Suffering from gout and obesity, he was renowned for his temper and violent manner, best encapsulated by his relationship with the Crown Prince Frederick. It soon became apparent that Frederick was effete, a Francophile, and cultured, all things that the king derided as unmanly. And that's not also to emphasize that the king was unintelligent. He was incredibly intelligent, and Frederick II would acknowledge this. They were simply of a completely different temperament and character. The prince regularly defied his father's regulation and was in turn often severely beaten by the king. After an incident where Frederick was attacked by his father for falling off his horse, he decided to fly on the idea of flight to England with his friend, tutor, and possible lover, depending on what your interpretation of the sexuality of Frederick II is, von Katter. The couple were easily caught, and the king forced his son to watch while von Katter was executed in front of him. Voltaire would later claim that the king wished to use this as a pretext to execute the crown prince and declare his favourite son, Augustus Wilhelm, as his heir. The emperor, Charles VI, intervened on the crown prince's behalf to declare that only the diet under the emperor could try the prince for treason. The prince was instead imprisoned and later compelled to marry Elizabeth of Brunswick, leaving father and son estranged and hostile for the remaining 8 years of the soldier king's reign. He died in 1740, the same year that the Habsburg dynasty would fall into turmoil. Leopold had set the precedent whereby he had tolerated the elevation of his nominal princely subjects, so long as they would follow his direction in foreign policy against France. With the conclusion of the Spanish Succession War, the new emperor, Charles VI, was forced yet again to appeal to the electors to ratify his pragmatic sanction. Until now, the empire had been governed by an amended version of Salic law, which established patrilineal male primogeniture, i.e. male firstborn succession through the male line. Already, the Spanish branch of the imperial Habsburg dynasty had gone extinct, with Spain now passing to the Bourbons. The Habsburgs were left with Spain's other European domains from Sicily to Belgium, and yet after the death of Joseph in 1711, the Holy Roman Emperor Joseph, who reigned from 1705 to 1711, the Austrian branch of the family was facing a succession crisis of its own, as both the sons of Leopold only had daughters. By Salic law, the Habsburgs would lose not only the emperorship, but their holdings in the empire, and possibly even Hungary, which was elective and not a hereditary monarchy. The issue was complicated further, as per the Mutual Pact of Succession in 1703, Charles VI, who had become Holy Roman Emperor in 1711, replacing his brother, had accepted the rights of his nieces by his brother over his own daughter, Mary Theresa. With the Pragmatic Sanction of 1713, Charles VI overturned both succession laws to make Mary Theresa his sole heir to the whole Habsburg patrimony, with the assumption essentially that her husband would be elected the Holy Roman Emperor. A note that the Pragmatic Sanction and the years 1713 and 1714 are significant for Habsburg historians in the sense that they usher in this entity historiographically known as the Habsburg monarchy, now sundered of its Spanish branch, its Spanish component, the original House of Burgundy. And yet the term, ironically, is applied post an edict meant to prevent the fallout from the extinction of the House of Habsburg in 1740, after which the house officially becomes the House of Lorraine, and it only retains the title Habsburg cosmetically. So the idea of a Habsburg monarchy is to deal with the fact that the Habsburg dynasty is actually going to, and later will become extinct. At first, Charles VI needed the recognition of the estates of his domains from Bohemia to Hungary to ensure the succession of his daughter, Mary Theresa. And in 1723, he gained a sanction for Hungary. The entirety of Charles's reign was dedicated to the question of the succession. And moreover, he was completely unsuccessful in his own lifetime to gain recognition, hold on to his collected domains, or to prevent a war of succession after his death. In Britain's capacity as a great power, an elector within the Holy Roman Empire, Austria was compelled to suspend its promising trading company in Ostend, while Charles's diplomatic contrivances with Spain and France saw the empire losing Lorraine, Austria, Naples, and Sicily, while the Bourbons established a powerful new dynastic alliance between France, Spain, southern Italy, the so-called Pacte de Famille, which was referencing last time. Oh, and just to emphasize, they didn't lose Austria, but rather the House of Austria lost Naples and Sicily, just in case I don't make that clear. Both the Houses of Saxony and Bavaria had better claims to the Habsburg patrimony than Mary Theresa via the original Pact of Mutual Succession, as both the male claimants, Frederick Christian of Saxony and Maximilian Christian of Bavaria, were both male matrilineal descendants of the Emperor Joseph I through their mothers, Maria Joseph and Maria Amalia, respectively. Understandably, neither the Wettins nor the Wittelsbachs wished to abjure their rights to the whole of the Habsburg patrimony. Ironically, only Prussia accepted the pragmatic sanction out of loyalty to the Habsburg dynasty. At the death of Charles, the treasury was empty, the army was in shambles, having just been defeated against the Ottomans and the French. And just compare that to the state of affairs left by his contemporary, who ruled at the same time, the Soldatenkönig, Frederick Wilhelm I of Prussia. Frederick Wilhelm I of Prussia did everything right to leave his son, Frederick II the Great, with an unblemished inheritance, whereas Mary Theresa, unfortunately for her, was left in a complete sham. Her situation was in complete disarray owing to the incompetence of her father. And Eugene of Savoy, the sword of the Habsburg dynasty and of the Holy Roman Emperor, had, when he was alive, decried the imbecility of the emperor's strategy, which depended entirely on the goodwill of foreign powers, circling like vultures around an Austrian carcass, while Austria itself was left without the hard power needed to impose the pragmatic sanction by force of arms. Now, Eugene of Savoy was dead, and Mary Theresa was left in this complete mess. Mary Theresa, therefore, and to make it even worse, Mary Theresa was deliberately kept out of the understanding of the affairs of government. Essentially, I think Charles VI wanted his daughter to become the ruler of the Habsburg patrimony and then assumed, because she was a woman, that the entire affairs of government would be managed by her advisors. But the terrible state of affairs which she had essentially inherited meant that she had to take the initiative, and she actually proved to be an incredibly competent ruler despite all the odds. And one of the first things she does is try and contrive a way by which the Habsburgs can nominally hold on to the Holy Roman Emperorship. And she has her husband, Francis of Lorraine, who is now Francis of Tuscany, who her idea essentially is to make him co-ruler in all things. He will become co-ruler of Bohemia, co-ruler of Hungary, co-ruler of Austria, and in that capacity, he will also become emperor. Nevertheless, as Eugene had predicted, the foreign powers all betrayed the pact, with the exception of Great Britain and the Netherlands. France and Spain and Prussia would go to war against Austria. The Saxons and the Bavarians stake their claim against Austria for the imperial crown. And following in the footsteps of the Winter King, Charles Albert of Bavaria, who was the essentially the nephew of Emperor Joseph, was welcomed into Prague by the Estates and was proclaimed King of Bohemia. With Bohemia under Wittelsbach control, the electors unanimously supported Charles Albert von Wittelsbach, who was married to Mary Theresa's Habsburg cousin Maria Amalia, as the new Holy Roman Emperor. Despite this considerable loss, Mary Theresa displayed an unexpected level of determination and cunning to ensure her inheritance. Having already won over the Hungarian and Austrian states, she insisted on a quick campaign against now Holy Roman Emperor Charles VII von Wittelsbach, seizing Munich, his capital, in a shocking winter campaign. And again, this against the advice of all her military advisors. With Munich captured and the Bavarians and the French allies split, half of them in Bohemia, half of them in the West, Bohemia was quickly retaken in 1743. Reduced as emperor to his imperial government in the city of Frankfurt, where all the imperial apparatus and institutions were, most of them anyway, Charles VII had to compensate for his complete evaporation of his power base by passing edicts such as the declarations of various universities. after a decisive French campaign, he briefly gained control of his capital of Munich for a couple of months before dying. And it was therefore after this culmination of four centuries of ambition for the Bavarian House of Wittelsbach to regain the office of the Holy Roman Emperor, all it amounted to was a three-year reign from Charles VII, and ultimately amounted to nothing more than a brief Habsburg interregnum. Francis Stephen, the husband of Mary Theresa, was elected as Holy Roman Emperor, who was in turn succeeded by his and Mary Theresa's son Joseph II of the Habsburg-Lorraine dynasty, hence the cosmetic Habsburg dynasty. They wouldn't want to be known as the Lorraine dynasty for obvious reasons, alluding to their greater patrimony in the Habsburg dynasty. The same thing happened to the Romanovs. Just a little note, the Romanov dynasty actually died out in 1730, and the dynasty, which was carried on by Peter III and Catherine the Great, was the dynasty of Romanov-Holstein-Gottorp. Saxony, meanwhile, had switched sides to support the Austrians, their claim amounting to nothing. And of course, I would actually argue that the Saxons had the best claim of anyone alive for the Austrian crown. Offsetting the triumph of the Austrians beginning to retain the imperial, or rather reconquer the imperial throne. In that same year of 1745, imperial forces and their British allies met with disaster at the Battle of Fontenoy, the French conquering the Austrian Netherlands and modern-day Belgium. A British blockade and an unusual act of generosity towards the Austrians caused Louis XV to abandon a conquest that would have trumped the gains of Louis XIV, returning the southern Netherlands to Austria in 1748. Mary Theresa had saved the Austrian inheritance, save for one notable exception, and it's here we come back to Prussia. I have underscored the Bavarian and Saxon claims on Austria thus far in the hope that the rise of Prussia must be placed in its proper context as all the more unexpected, indeed remarkable. For it would not be Saxony or Bavaria that would land the decisive blow on the Austrians and thus bring about an era of German dualism, joint power, diarchy, but Prussia. Prussia, as previously stated, was powerful, wealthy, and crucially loyal to the Habsburgs under Frederick Wilhelm I. Frederick II had come to the throne of Prussia a mere few months before the death of Emperor Charles VI. Frederick II, on the topic of his father, would claim that although terrible, he would achieve rested on the foundation of his father's tireless efforts. Nevertheless, his father had done nothing to remedy Prussia's disadvantageous geography. Prussia was divided into two major regions. I'll just go back to the map here. Prussia was divided into two major regions, Brandenburg and East Prussia, discontinuous with a scattering of territories from Westphalia and the Cleves on the Rhine. Frederick Wilhelm I believed that good relations with his neighbours in the Empire and Poland would secure Prussia's territorial integrity. So when Frederick II, who in no way thought along the same lines, came to the throne, he was already set on expansion to secure the links between his various territories, and concluded a secret treaty of alliance with France. Upon the death of Charles VI, Frederick lay claim to Silesia based on the ancient pious claim, which I've already delineated, which date back to 1537. Which had been utilized both by Frederick I and the Great Elector over the issue of the small enclave of Schwabus. And just to point out that Frederick II's concerns for his kingdom were economic and strategic. To my mind, his dynastic claims were weak and always subordinate to the practical considerations of establishing a powerful, continuous sovereign kingdom. To that end, Silesia was one of the most densely industrialized and prosperous regions in the Habsburg monarchy. Mary Theresa would refer to it as the most beautiful gem in my crown, and in the empire as a whole. And also it was a major sort of estuary of the Oder River, which was Prussia's main sort of thoroughfare for navigation and trade. Silesia had been made, part of the Bohemian crown for centuries, and Mary Theresa flatly rejected Frederick's ultimatum to hand over parts of Silesia, fearing that if she made any concessions, she would be abdicating her rights to her entire succession, which is fair enough. If you begin piecemealy giving in to everyone who demands something of you, especially someone who was seen as nothing more than leading a second-rate power like Prussia, Mary Theresa had absolutely no hope of holding on any elements of her succession. even with her her indomitable policy towards retaining the entire succession, she still was invaded and temporarily lost both the emperorship and Bohemia. Regardless, Frederick overran the entire province in a few weeks during the winter of 1740-41. Mary Theresa had been forced to release one of the generals locked up by her father, Nieperg, from prison, as she was in desperate need of a competent general to combat Prussia. And again, just to emphasize that Eugen of Savoy had been dead now for 5 years. Nieperg and Frederick II met at Mollwitz, where the Prussian king won his first military victory. The knock-on effect of Mollwitz was to convince Bavaria and France to escalate the War of Succession, convinced of Austrian weakness. And essentially, what's more, the more remarkable about Mollwitz is that Austria was defeated by what was universally considered to be a second-rate power. By 1742, the Austrian situation was so dire, with the loss of Bohemia and the election of Charles VII as Holy Roman Emperor, that they all but conceded Silesia, apart from a tiny little area of Austrian or Bohemian Silesia, which is still part of Czechia today. This was, however, but a ceasefire to the Austrians, as they soon regained the initiative, as I've already elucidated, against France and Bavaria. Frederick was the master of preemptive strategy, always attacking before his potential enemy could gain the initiative, and fearing that Austria's gains in the war would redirect them back towards Silesia, Frederick invaded Austrian-held Bohemia in 1744. The Saxons had now switched sides to support Austria, and it's pretty obvious to understand why, because as you can see on this map, we have the Saxon patrimony, the Wettin patrimony here in pink, and across here in brown, we have Poland, Lithuania. And essentially Prussia straddling and controlling this region meant that Saxony now had a major German military power blocking off access between Saxony and Poland-Lithuania. So much better to have a weak and allied power there, or even better, try and establish or stake your claim to a land corridor in that claim. So it's quite understandable why the Saxons, despite their very good claim on the Habsburg patrimony, switched sides to attack Prussia. And understanding that Frederick the Great and his army was superlative in the field, they at first, the Saxons and the Austrians, employed Fabian tactics, attacking logistics and supply trains rather than attacking the army directly. And when the Austro-Saxon army was eventually committed, forced into a pitched battle at Hohenfriedburg, they were crushed by Frederick, who invaded Bohemia again, while the old Dessauer, Leopold I of Anhalt-Dessau, the top general of Frederick Wilhelm I, occupied Dresden. Once again, Austria was forced to recognize Silesia as Prussian. Mary Theresa would not accept the permanent loss of Silesia, or the notion that she would have to share authority over Germany with Prussia as a new great power. To this end, she reformed the Austrian administration, and for a more thoroughgoing analysis of this, I've already done a video called The Habsburg Monarchy, which we talk about cameralism and other effects she made, you know, changes she made to the Austrians and the Bohemian Chancellery, if you want to go and look at that. But for the sake of this conversation, we're just talking about the diplomatic revolution. So she pursues good relations with Elizabeth I of Russia. You can see here at the top, that's a famous image of her standing outside Tsarskoye Selo, her palace complex, which had been designed for her by Rustrelli, the Italian architect. And again, she is essentially very similar to Frederick I. She is a mercenary empress. Russia has the largest army in Europe, and Russia is in a position, essentially has no major rivals now that Sweden has been crushed and Poland has been reduced increasingly to that of a client state. And eventually the Ottoman Empire will be crushed under her successor, Catherine the Great. So during the reign of Elizabeth, the Russian army is essentially a mercenary army, an army for hire. And because of that, and because of Austria's great demand to get back the great jewel in the crown of Silesia, Russia is tempted again to essentially utilize her force in the service of the Austrian Empress. Now, to counteract the Austro-Russian Entente, Frederick looked to Hanover and its joint state of Great Britain for support in the Convention of Westminster, whereby he gained Hanover Great Britain as an ally. Nevertheless, the convention promised that Prussia would become the guarantor of Hanover against the might of France. As the treaty was explicitly anti-French, Mary Theresa was able to pull off a political masterstroke whereby Louis XV, under the influence of his mistress, Madame de Pompadour, who was in contact with the Austrian foreign minister von Kaunitz, became allied to Austria in the diplomatic revolution of 1756. Austria and France being allied together is all the more remarkable if you consider the last 300 years of history, which have been covered on this channel. The emergence of Prussia as a great power had fundamentally altered France's perception of Austria and the Holy Roman Empire as a hostile monolith, since Austria's authority was now seriously contested within, and thus the threat of the Empire to France was thus receding. Moreover, in return, the French supported the reconquest of Silesia. France was promised the Austrian Netherlands as compensation. Britain was France's major rival, so now was Prussia by association. Understanding his strategic miscalculation, Frederick invaded and occupied Austrian allied Saxony, triggering the Seven Years' War, or what I'm going to call here the War of the League of the Three Petticoats, the three petticoats being Madame de Pompadour, Mary Theresa, and the Empress Elizabeth, which is what Frederick dubbed them. And of course, recalling this, so it seems there's less association with the more familiar conflict I'm sure people in English-speaking countries are aware of, which is that of the war in Canada. And the various knock-on effect that's going to have for the American war, but no, this is going to be the German-focused war. The annexation of Saxony, Frederick had judged to be a military necessity for what he had expected to be a long conflict, pressing the Saxon army into service and exploiting the electorate for its resources and garrisoning its fortresses. Nevertheless, it was this invasion without any diplomatic pretext that furthered Prussia's isolation. With Saxony secure, he repeated his strategy of attacking Bohemia, only to be defeated by the larger Austrian army under von Daun at Kolin. This defeat was reversed by Frederick the Great's stunning victories at Rossbach and Leuthen. Frederick had hoped that these two victories would have forced a quick end to the hostilities, and yet Mary Theresa understood that she held the advantage in a long war, and that the League possessed significantly more men and resources, and she was prepared to accept the costs in order to regain Silesia and have her revenge on Prussia, ending any notion of sharing power or the idea of German dualism. Every battle for Prussia, meanwhile, would lower the quality of the army with losses it could ill afford. And again, the model of this is essentially what happened in the Great Northern War for Sweden. Sweden was seen as a military hegemon, the greatest army in Europe, and it was faced with, again, the almost inexhaustible supply of men and materials from the alliance of Denmark, Russia, and Poland, Lithuania. And it is that which ultimately defeated and destroyed the Swedish, the fact that every battle, regardless if it was a victory, cost the Swedish army men they couldn't afford to replace. While Frederick invaded the monarchy, the Habsburg monarchy, this time through Moravia, the Russians had occupied East Prussia and were advancing on Berlin, stalled them at the Pyrrhic victory at Zorndorf, but was ultimately defeated the Austrians of Hofkirch, following which the Prussians lost the initiative for the rest of the war. At the Battle of Kunersdorf, Frederick II was defeated by the Austro-Russian army and lost half of his own men, and would have been killed himself were it not for a bullet lodging itself in his snuffbox. Frederick was saved in this first miracle of the House of Brandenburg when the coalition failed to take Berlin after Kunersdorf, though Saxony was lost. In 1761, the British, having effectively won the colonial war, dumped the Prussians as an ally. Essentially, the only thing keeping the Prussians in the war had been a strong stem of subsidies from Britain. And the minute, essentially, the Prussians were very useful for the British for tying down the French forces in Europe. But now that the colonial war had essentially been won by 1761, that distraction was no longer needed, and so the Prussians were cut off. By 1762, Pomerania was under Russian occupation. It appeared that Prussia was finished, till Elizabeth I died, and in one of those historically inexplicable moments, Peter of Holstein-Gottorp, now Peter III of Russia, and a Frederick II fanatic, declared an immediate end to the war for Russia's part, and lent Frederick the Russian army for the remainder of the conflict, declaring, "I'd rather be a Prussian general than Tsar of Russia." France was exhausted after their crushing defeat at the hands of Britain. Austria was politically isolated and forced to make peace, respecting the pre-war status quo. Hence, we have the second miracle of the House of Prussia. Peter III was quickly deposed, unexpectedly, but his wife and usurper, Catherine II, were prepared to continue the Prussia-Russian alliance. While Prussia had lost no territory after Britain had cut off its subsidies, Frederick had debased the currency, leading to rampant inflation. The army was devastated, as was the population. Prussia would not recover to its pre-war levels for a decade. Despite the devastation inflicted on Prussia, the upstart great power and its king had survived, and so ended any serious chance of Austria reversing the state of German dualism. Austria was compelled to share its authority in Germany with Prussia for the next century. While Prussia is remembered for being particularly bellicose, these were the only major conflicts fought during the long reign of Frederick II, some 46 years. After 1763, he focused on furthering Prussia's objectives through diplomacy, through the implicit threat of an army of some 200,000 men, only rivaled by Austria, France, and Russia. Now Frederick needed to complete his territorial objectives, namely by acquiring the rural Prussian territories of Poland, separating Prussian Pomerania from Prussia proper, now East Prussia, actually no, now Kaliningrad Oblast, part of Russia. His original plan to take the region by force was scuppered by the onset of the Seven Years' War. So instead, throughout the 1760s and 1770s, Frederick worked to weaken Poland politically and economically. Minting was an integral part of Frederick's strategy, and he had devastated the Polish-Saxon economy by minting and debasing their coinage for use during the war. Next, Frederick began to construct custom forts on the main Polish river and trade artery, the Vistula. When the Polish Parliament attempted to, again, essentially revert back to political Catholicism, to reunify the state through religious association, Frederick cast himself in the role of the protector of Poland's Protestants. One of the first acts of the new Prusso-Russian alliance between Frederick II and Catherine II, both of them would later be given the epithet by Voltaire the Great, was to place Stanislaw Poniatowski, Catherine's former lover, on the throne of Poland-Lithuania. Frederick played both the Russians and the Austrians against each other. In the latter instance, convincing the Austrians to participate in the partitioning of Poland to compensate Austria for Russia's gains in the Crimea. Through the first partition of Poland in 1772, Austria gained the Kingdom of Galicia-Lodomeria, while Prussia gained West Prussia. While on the surface, Prussia gains were tiny compared to Austria, acquiring land with a population of 600,000 compared to Austria's 2.5 million, and even Russia's 1.3 million, control over West Prussia gave Frederick II control over the Vistula and finally connected Prussia to Brandenburg for the first time in the near two centuries' existence of the union between Prussia and Brandenburg. The land previously belonging to the Polish crown and the Catholic Church was appropriated by the Prussian state, and German settlement was encouraged, and the rights of the local Polish nobility were curtailed. While Bavaria had profited from the fallout of the Austrian succession, by 1777, Bavaria was facing a succession crisis of its own, to which Austria hoped to profit. But the rise of Prussia had transformed the diplomatic equation. In 1777, Maximilian Joseph, son of Charles VII, died, leaving the senior branch of the Wittelsbachs descended from the two Holy Roman Emperors, Ludwig IV and Charles VII, extinct. Moreover, the distant Wittelsbach cousin in line to succeed was Charles Theodore Elector Palatinate. The Treaty of Westphalia expressly forbade Bavaria and the Palatinate uniting, a clause guaranteed by France. Joseph II, Holy Roman Emperor, advanced a weak claim as the brother-in-law to the previous elector to the Bavarian inheritance. Joseph II was interested in transforming the multi-ethnic Habsburg monarchy into a centralized German-speaking state, so acquiring Bavaria would not only increase the number of ethnic Germans in the monarchy, but also increase the relative power of Austria in Germany vis-a-vis Prussia. Charles Theodore, for his part, had no interest in Bavaria, despite it being grander than the Palatinate. He had dedicated his life to expanding his own court at Mannerheim, and Joseph II promised possible territorial concessions in the Austrian Netherlands as compensation. Charles Theodore interpreted this as the entire Austrian Netherlands, a renewed Burgundian state between France and the Rhine. And yet, as Austrian troops occupied his domain, it became apparent that Joseph II would only exchange Bavaria for French-speaking territories such as Luxembourg, Namur, and Hainaut, essentially modern-day Wallonia and Luxembourg, of course. Nevertheless, Charles Theodore was still content to give up Bavaria to the horror of his cousin and heir, Charles II of Zweibrücken, the Zweibrücken branch of the Wittelsbach family. Compounding Charles II's horror was the suggestion that Charles Theodore would immediately apportion his gains from Austria to his illegitimate sons. So essentially, we have the Palatinate branch of the family. He's prepared to give up his inheritance in Bavaria, and in compensation, he is prepared to gain places like possible areas in Austrian Swabia, further Austria, Luxembourg, Namur, Hainaut. And so he's already essentially sacrificing the inheritance of his cousin, Charles II of Zweibrücken. And to make matters worse, rather than allowing his cousin to inherit all of that territory, because Charles Theodore of the Palatinate does not have a legitimate heir, he only has two daughters, he only has a series of bastards, he instead is interested in affording places like Swabia, Luxembourg, Namur, and giving them to his bastards, the territories he would gain from the Austrian partition. So for the heir, Charles II of Zweibrücken, and for many of the German princes, this is simply unacceptable. Saxony, which also had dynastic claims to Bavaria through marriage, supported Charles II in opposition to this partition plan. They allied to Frederick II of Prussia, who was more than willing to stifle the Austrian plan, and invaded Bohemia, though avoided a decisive engagement with Joseph. In the event, Joseph, despite being the Holy Roman Emperor, was overruled by his mother Mary Theresa, while Frederick II built a coalition against Austria, including Russia. France was already supporting the American revolutionaries against England, Great Britain, and would not intervene to guarantee the division as anticipated, and so Joseph II, isolated, alone, was compelled to let Bavaria go. When Joseph II pressed his claim to a receptive Charles Theodore again in 1784, the remarkable thing about Charles Theodore always trying to surrender his realm of Bavaria, in this case it would have been for the entire Austrian Netherlands, Frederick II again formed a new coalition called the Fürstenbund, literally leagues of princes, princes in the German Empire, Fürst, literally meaning first, which is of course the same sort of etymological root in Latin, princeps, prince, first. And in this case, the Fürstenbund consisted of Prussia, Hanover, and Saxony, and other minor princes, including the most senior clergyman in Germany, the Archbishop of Mainz, to safeguard the so-called German liberties. The Fürstenbund was established to check the ambitions of the emperor, and after the death of Frederick II, Joseph II in 1790, the organization disappeared before it could have been utilized against France in the revolution. Austria did gain the Innviertel region of Bavaria, which contains Braunau am Inn. I'm sure you most know the significance of that place. In contrast to attempts of later historiography to claim Frederick II as the progenitor of German nationalism and unification, I wish to emphasize what historian Christopher Clark has called the Prussian enigma. As the philosopher of Sanssouci, his Potsdam palace, Frederick the Great hosted French thinkers such as Diderot and Voltaire, who bestowed him the epithet the Great. Like many European rulers at the time, who were influenced by the prestige of Louis XIV, of France and his court, Frederick adopted French tastes and manners, though in Frederick's case, the extent of his Francophile tendencies might also have been a reaction to the austerity of the family environment created by his father, the Soldatenkönig, who had a deep aversion for France and promoted an austere Calvinist culture for his state. He was educated by French tutors, and almost all the books in his library, which cover topics as diverse as mathematics, art and politics, the classics, of course, history, were by French authors, written in French. French was Frederick's preferred language for speaking and for writing, though he often had to rely on proofreaders when it came to the actual spelling of his words. Though Frederick used German as his working language with his administration and with the army, he claimed to have never learnt it properly and never fully mastered speaking or writing it. He also disliked the German language, thinking it was inharmonious and awkward. He once commented that German authors pile parentheses upon parentheses, and often you find at the end of an entire page the verb on which depends the meaning of the whole sentence. He considered the German culture of his time, particularly literature and theatre, to be inferior to that of France, believing that it had been hindered by the devastation of the Thirty Years' War, and this very much he echoes the German New Humanist and Schiller. He suggested that it would eventually become the equal of its rivals, but this would require the codification of the language and the emergence of a new artistic cadre of German an extensive essentially patronage of the arts by German rulers. In this sense, Frederick the Great is actually very prophetic for what is going to happen with German romanticism and German philosophy over the next 50 years. And of course, this was something that Frederick simply believed was beyond him and the confines of his own life. He disapproved of luxury and the extravagance of the French royal court, however, so it wasn't only one sort of way in terms of his appreciation of France. And his own court remained quite Spartan, frugal, and restricted to a limited circle of close friends. And if you look at the Palace of Sanssouci, it's tiny. It's essentially a orangerie rather than, let's say, a full royal palace. It's a very intimate setting for a very small number of the inner circle of the king. And again, it's despite the Francophile tendencies of the king, the intellectual sort of life he cultivated and spawned in Berlin made Berlin one of the great centres of the German Enlightenment and really put Berlin on the centre of the map. And before, Berlin had just been this parochial backwater city. It really became a cosmopolitan centre, even though this was a trend that had already established by the time of the Great Elector some 100 years before. Moreover, Frederick II rebuked the Calvinism of his father, adopting a lofty attitude of religious skepticism, becoming a Freemason, while maintaining the policies of tolerance in Prussia established in the 17th century. Under his reign, Masons, Jews, and Catholics were protected in the nominally Protestant state. Tolerance as policy, combined with the absolute state he inherited and refined, lent the name of his regime to enlightened absolutist, a system that was rejected by Mary Theresa, but enthusiastically imitated by Joseph II of Austria, his nominal rival. This tolerance extended to relaxing censorship, abolishing torture, in most capacities anyway, and limiting capital punishment. Economically, Frederick again looked to France, imitating a style of indirect taxation and hiring Frenchmen to introduce it. Likewise, he adopted elements of mercantilism, which often appear to go hand in hand with absolutist monarchies, reducing internal barriers to trade while protecting the Prussian economy via external tariffs. Der Alte Fritz was a legend in his own lifetime and beyond. Prussia had arisen as a major military power out of necessity to counteract Swedish domination, and the army was used to leverage a kingdom for the said elector. The Prussian kings were absolute in their domestic power, vaunted for their military prowess, and true to their Habsburg overlords, until Frederick II used that accumulated power against the Habsburgs. Frederick II overturned the international order, and despite his appeal to Prussian virtue as the anti-Machiavelli, he operated under the famous maxim, necessity knows no laws. When finding, after two decades of conflict, that peace suited Prussia, Prussia assumed a role as international broker and defender of German liberty against the ambitions of the emperor, hearkening back to the legacy of the 30 Years' War, the Schmalkaldic League, and the Golden Bull of 1356. By the time of the death of Frederick the Great, Prussia had imposed its will on Europe, and Germany found itself the centre of not one, but two great powers, establishing the system of German dualism until German unification from 1866 until 1870. So there you have it. That is the end of this evening's lecture. So if you do have any questions, there are no super chats, or I haven't seen any super chats. So if you do have any questions or wish to send a super chat, do send it now. While I'm sort of anticipating a flurry of questions and super chats, I won't hold my breath. I'll just talk about my thoughts for the future of Nations of Charlemagne series. I've been thinking I really don't want to push the series beyond 30 episodes. I'm almost thinking it's become excessively long at this point. And I'm thinking what would be a good sort of thematic end to the Nations of Charlemagne. Obviously, this is a story about France, Germany, and Italy. But also it's an idea about monarchy and universal monarchy. So very much I feel, you know, Napoleon would possibly be a good end point for this conversation. But then again, I don't think so, because Napoleon had imitators, and indeed we have the Second French Empire after his death. And also, this is also a story of the Catholic monarchy, the endurance of a Roman Empire in the West that began with Charlemagne and really ends with Blessed Charles in 1918. However, I've already broken Austria off post 1866 and created another series which I really need to get back to, which is the anatomy of Austria-Hungary. So I was thinking that maybe the German unification and the Italian unification and the defeat of Napoleon III of France would be therefore a natural endpoint for the nations of Charlemagne. Because at that point, what essentially I've done is that because the nations don't exist, because Italian and German relations are so interconnected with all of these nations of Charlemagne, so to speak, my natural impulse has been to make it a comparative history. But come 1870, 1871, we now have distinct national histories, which didn't exist before. And so I think it would be possibly a good place where we see the creation of the new states. We have the residue of the nations of Charlemagne coming out of this. And with the defeat of Napoleon III, we have the new nations, the formal nations, the modern nations of France, Germany, and Italy. So as I've done with Austria-Hungary, I'll probably retroactively make that not the fourth series, but like an addendum to the second series, an addendum to Nations of Charlemagne. And with that being the end, so there'll be, 29 or 30 episodes to the whole series, I'll then go back and do a few episodes for France, a few episodes for Germany, a few episodes for Italy. So for France, this will be covering the Third, Fourth, Fifth Republics. With Germany, this will be covering the Kaiserreich, the Weimar Republic, the Third Reich, and what else will we be covering? And West Germany and East Germany, probably going as far as German unification in 1990. And then with Italy, we'll cover after Italian unification, the original Italian kingdom, Italy's participation of World War I, the fascist government under Mussolini, and the fallout after the Italian Civil War and the years of lead. And those will probably be three nice little series to accompany Anatomy of Austria-Hungary. So there'll be Nations of Charlemagne, and there'll be four little spin-off series to complement that, because I feel that after we've reached German and Italian unification, there is less of a necessity to do this comparative approach, which I've tried thus far, and hopefully it's been relatively interesting. So that's my little spiel all over, and I'll go back and see if there have been any questions. Still no super chats. I feel so insulted. Please. I put all this work in. Oh, it is rather exhausting. But yeah, I still enjoy it, and I enjoy sort of, you know, rehashing these topics. But nevertheless, it would be very much appreciated, and I would thank you so much. Napoleon, the degenerate monarch, well, he wasn't that degenerate, all things considered. There'd be many other monarchs who have been infinitely more degenerate than Napoleon. Barbarian for HeroQuest has asked me, did Brandenburg have a particularly militaristic tradition before Frederick Wilhelm, or did Prussian militarism begin with him and Frederick the Great? Well, the Prussian army began with the Great Elector, and it began out of the necessity of Brandenburg being this waste, essentially a buffer state between Austria and Sweden. As a result, during the 30 Years' War, it's the same with Saxony. Brandenburg was invaded continuously from Swedish Pomerania and from Austrian Silesia. So practically, and imitating the style of France, the Great Elector looked to France and looked at the way that Louis XIV had combined absolutism and, you know, land cultivation, improving the economy, but also combining this with a large army, staffed with the, you know, lower ranks of the nobility who had been hostile to the French monarchy during the Fronde at the beginning of his reign. I think, you know, Prussian militarism began during the reign of the Great Elector out of necessity, and again, mainly against Sweden. which is the point I need to note in terms of establishing some sort of teleology of the great Brandenburg-Prussian struggle against Austria, is that the Prussian army was founded to counteract Sweden, not Austria. Austria, and again, the remarkable thing about the Austrian rulers, sorry, the Prussian rulers before Frederick II, is their remarkable loyalty, Treue, to the Habsburgs. But other than that, I mean, if you were going to draw some sort of tenuous link to the Teutonic Order, Prussia itself, the state in Marienburg, was formed as essentially a conquest state, a crusader state, the state of the Teutonic Order in Prussia, which had replaced the previous culture akin to the Lithuanians, the pagan Lithuania, the old Prussian culture, and was settled by the Germans and became very militaristic. Their base wasn't in Königsberg, it was in Marienburg, which is now Malbork in Poland. This region was conquered by Poland in the 15th century, and the Teutonic Order was humbled and later secularized, going from a monastic order into a duchy, which was inherited by Brandenburg. So again, if you were to draw an earlier conclusion, again, what Frederick Wilhelm I is doing is he's engaging a bit of historical revisionism in the sense that he's taking Prussianism associated with the Teutonic Order, and he's imposing it in what is ultimately a Brandenburg-led state run by Berlin. So, yeah, that would be my answer to that question, a very long-winded answer to that question. Right. How on earth do you remember so much? I do have notes. So I may appear far more knowledgeable than I really am, but I do have to rely on notes. Especially when I'm going over so many names. And I mean, I could do this, but it would be far more rambling. And I try and make the point as concise as possible. So I like to be prepared in that sense. Sonia Braut, reading lists available prior to your lectures. Yes, if you go on the description for this video, and thank you, Sonia Braut, for $6.99 Canadian dollars, you will see the reading list, which is available, which I encourage everyone to read before the discussion component to this episode, which will be taking place on Monday. As for any sort of associated, reading, I'm not sure about that, but for now, all the reading which is set for this topic is in the, I mean, essentially the two main historians, one for the Habsburgs and the Empire side and one for the Prussian side, Peter Wilson for the Empire side and Christopher Clark for the Prussian side will give you a good introduction. They're very decent historians. So I would go and check them both out. Right. Extra special K for $2. Thank you for putting so much work into this. Well, thank you very much. It's nice to have that sort of level of appreciation. So thank you very much. You make this all possible. I have to justify spending so much time on this in some way, other than just doing it as a hobby. Right, Vingo. I've been to Malbork, built by Teutonic Knights, the largest single brick castle in the world. It is pretty impressive, isn't it? It is pretty fantastic. The wonderful red brick castle of the Teutonic Order, which is still there, it wasn't destroyed. All the more remarkable considering how many times it's been invaded, especially by the Soviets. But no, it's still there. You can go and visit. King Jacques, I know you have covered Spanish history as part of Nations of Charlemagne because of the Austrian connection, but will you ever do an Iberian Peninsula Western Mediterranean series? Yes, it's just a matter of time. As of now, I've just mentioned that Nations of Charlemagne, I will conclude around 1870, and then I will do spin-off national histories. I've already doing one for Austria, and I'll do one for Prussia, and I'll do one for, sorry, Germany, and I'll do one for France, and I will do one for Italy. As it pertains to Spain, so Iberian history, obviously referring to Castile, Aragon, Granada, Portugal, Navarre, Basque country, you know, the Arab invasion, the Caliphate of Cordoba. That would be interesting. It's just a matter of when I'm going to organize to have it, because after this series is done and Orthodoxy, Autocracy and Nationality is done, and probably then after a spin-off on the Soviet Union is done, I will be, as promised, doing a history on medieval England and before, medieval Great Britain, which I've called the Children of Albion. Right, so yeah, it's just a matter of time. Right, oops, my bad, thank you. Well, yes, I don't want to sort of like advertise too much, because I don't want to ostracize people by constantly putting out, you know, where the reading lists are. But no, just always check the descriptions. If I do have any set reading, and I do try and put out the video, the Streamlabs thing, as early as I possibly can as well. So you do have, you know, a couple of days at least, or you know, a week ideally, if you want to do the reading before we get to the lecture. Barbarian from HeroQuest, thanks for the answer and the great streams. Well, thank you very much. So you've had a question and a super chat thanking me for the question. So thank you very much. Extra Special K again for $2. What's your take on the Codex Urelinderboek? Yes, well, that's Dutch mythology, isn't it? I don't know really anything about Dutch mythology or Dutch esotericism. I know that there are elements of it. I mean, all I know about it is the National Socialist Association through Verf. I don't really know anything about the original script. And I know it was derided by Rosenberg. So... interesting. I'll have to go into that. Maybe that'll be part of my my lecture on Nazism as an ideology. Marburg was also used by the Germans in World War II, and was shelled quite heavily. Yes, indeed. Right. Judge Caligula Bushman. Should we blame the Prussians for the ethnic divergence between Germans and Austrians? No. German dualism was established, and many people like Schiller at the time were lamenting the fact that there was such a tangible division into two states. And again, the issue with some historians is to retroactively, and again, Schiller is a great historian for the time. He's also sort of one of the leading lights in terms of the philosophy of history, which will emerge in the German school. But going back, you can't sort of retroactively impose a narrative on history as convenient as it is to try and do that or find some thematic link, because you have your sort of adding an element of predestination, of determinism into your historical thinking, which I would necessarily avoid. There is no ethnic divergence between the Germans and Austrians. They are both Germans. In terms of a cultural divergence, this really only becomes apparent after the Klein Deutschland was created in 1870, and Austria was excluded from it. And Austrian Christian socials were trying to find a new German nationality, which was associated with loyalty to the Habsburg dynasty and Catholicism, to counteract the quite a large number of people who were appealed to this idea of separating from the Habsburgs and joining with Germany, even converting to Protestantism like Schönerer. So yes, the Prussians did, and Bismarck, this is slightly later in the history. You can't attribute this to here, because there is no indication whatsoever that Prussia is going to form a German nation state. There are hints of it, but still Austria is the major power, and Austria holds the position of Holy Roman Emperor. The Prussians only force Austria out of German politics entirely in 1866 after Königgrätz, so that's a little bit later. So they can be blamed for that. But Bismarck was forming a small Germany for very obvious reasons. He wanted a larger Prussia in a smaller Germany, so Prussia would be more dominant over that German creation and wouldn't succumb to essentially liberal impetus for, you know, creating a unitary state based in Frankfurt, which was essentially the alternative afforded by 1848. So, you can blame that, but the actual sort of definitive distinction between Austrians and Germans only comes about after the Second World War. So a lot of blame to go around, right? Extra special K. Will you have a series on Scandinavia? Very unlikely, I'm afraid. We've covered a tiny bit of Danish and Swedish history. I might do a stream on Charles the 12th, because I find Charles the 12th fascinating, but very unlikely to do a stream on just Scandinavian history, I'm afraid, because I know very little, especially about their history pre-Kalmar Union. Right. Colonel Crayon, my goodness, thank you very much. £50 super chat. Thank you. I can see underneath you said, oops, forgot to attach a message, and I can see it here. I was going to thank you for your hard work and ask if you were going to cover the English Civil War and Cromwell. Yes. As part of this Children of Albion series, it is going to cover everything from, I don't know, probably from the Roman conquest. So 41, 40. I'm getting my years wrong. No, 41 AD, when Claudius launches his conquest of England, probably going a little bit before that, probably before Claudius. And we will go all the way up until 1688. Or actually, no, maybe 1685, maybe the death of Charles II as opposed to James II. And then after that, so that'll obviously include the English Civil War and Cromwell, which takes place during the 1640s. And from there, there will be a series which comes in to sort of complement that called Empire of Finance, or I might call it something different, something that sounds slightly better when it actually comes to that point. Which will cover Dutch, Great British, and American history from the 1609 onwards. Right. Sorry, just going through the remainder of the super chats. Right. There is a lot of appreciation, which I can read, which is very much appreciated. But I think that's the end of the questions. Here we are. I'd appreciate a deep dive on the Codex, Ora Lindeboek, and how we know it's fake or how we know it's fake. I know a lot of Americans who think it's real. As interesting as it is, again, my knowledge of essentially all, you know, occult understanding and literature and myth in general, especially German myth, is received secondhand from the 19th century onwards, because that's not my area. Possibly, I mean, if Columba can convince me to do a heterodox episode and like 6 months or so, I might do it. But like I said, I have really very limited knowledge of anything to do with it. So it's rather unlikely as things stand. So yes, right, that's it. Thank you very much. Just to remind everyone that on Monday, there will be a discussion component to this episode on Deutsches Dualismus, German dualism, with, I expect, Columba and Ryan Turnipseed. So all check in and watch that episode as well. Thank you all very much for listening, and